all rise. Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Cherry presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 54617, Ronnie Coleman versus State. Mr. Wittes for the appellant, Mr. McCarthy for the respondent. This is the northern panel of the Supreme Court. Justice Gibbons to my right, Justice Pickering to my left. Good morning, Mr. Wittes.
Good morning, Your Honor. Dennis Wittes on behalf of the appellant. I'll be reserving 5 minutes, so I think all I can hit really is some bullet points to begin until I get some focus from the panel here. And I would just say that if these two charges, the ADW, assault with a deadly weapon, and armed robbery, had been tried separately, there would still be sufficient error to undermine any confidence in the guilty verdicts of those two charges. They're sort of like runaway trains. Each of the errors render the trials on those charges separate runaway trains. We have the limitation on cross-examination of the state's two primary witnesses on the armed robbery, the accomplice Rosie Davis, and then the victim Sal Murillo. And so we have limitations in that regard. We have instructional error with regards to the Weaver count of the officer that shot my client. And then, yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Wittes, I'm just curious on the timeline on this one. It appears it's within minutes between the time of the robbery until the first encounter with Officer Weaver and all like that. How does that play into the severance issue?
Right, the severance issue, and I've got a timeline here. It could have been 5 minutes. It could have been 15 minutes. I, in preparation for this, went back and reviewed the record a bit for a timeline on how this plays, and I can specifically address that here in about 15 seconds.
Okay.
Because I believe that severance is the main issue to be resolved here. I mean, these two, runaway trains, might have been, train wrecks. They became a tragedy when they ran into each other and there was a joint trial. And so severance is the predominant overarching issue to be considered here. And Mr. Murillo testified that he ended up at the top of this hill with Rosie Davis for sexual purposes a little after 11 o'clock. The testimony from the dispatch, Ella Carthen, indicated that the, I believe the first response in Volume 9, page 2124 from the dispatch records was 11:42 p.m. So we've got somewhere between a little after 11 p.m. and 11:42. We have Robinson and Nieder, some eyewitnesses on the other side of this street, perhaps 100 feet away, 70 feet away, witnessing these activities, the car pulling in, Murillo's car pulling in, backing up this hill, up halfway up a hill to this church where it's nice and dark and you get a little view. And then seeing, it could have been, according to Steve Robinson, 15 minutes before then Mr. Coleman goes up. It could have been 5 minutes. It was somewhere between 5 and 15 minutes. And then immediately after that, he sees Ms. Davis coming down, and almost immediately after that, or at some point, Mr. Coleman coming down. But then we've got, and so he's starting at 11 o'clock, Murillo's starting at 11 o'clock, and then what we've got here is the dispatch records that put it at 11:42 at the first encounter with Officer Weaver. So between the completion of the robbery, let's just say Mr. Coleman did it. We're going to assume, you know, that. I mean, he was convicted of that. And so let's just say the incident resulting in the robbery conviction up on the hill and the encounter with Officer Weaver down here, yeah, it's minutes. It's not seconds. It's not split seconds. It's some amount of time. And clearly, Mr. Coleman had completed everything that needed to be completed to complete the robbery. I reference and I discuss in my opening brief Fouquet, the old decision, with some fairly expansive language about what a robbery is all about. We got to remember, Fouquet involved a felony murder charge of killing a robbery victim a few miles away from where the robbery started. The defendant robbed a gas station attendant, stole the guy's car, drove him down the road however many miles to a secluded spot, sort of a Wright Jefferson kidnapping, you know, issue. We talk about this in that other context a lot. Mm-hmm. And then down there, the road at a secluded spot killed the fella. And so the court was dealing with whether or not it was felony murder, the death of the robbery victim, and whether or not robbery encompassed that. And under those circumstances, it did. Same victim. All of the cases involve same victims. Payne, the other case that I reference in my opening brief, dealing with, you know, an expansive application of, you know, when does robbery start and end? You know, that talked about very specific facts of multiple robberies, almost contemporaneous. But here we have a situation where it's different victims, different offenses, different circumstances, and they shouldn't have been tried together.
Can you tell me how, if the robbery case had been tried separately, how would the evidence have come in with respect to your client's position on the ground, lying on top of ostensibly the ATM card and the rest of it that are tied to the ADW?
Right. You know, how, as I mentioned in my reply brief, how that all came about, that's irrelevant. That should have been, like, redacted out or excluded out under 48035. I mean, it was unnecessary for anybody to prove in a crime for the Murillo robbery how Mr. Coleman came to be arrested. Very rarely, unless there's statements given, is the context of somebody's arrest relevant.
How about the identity issue of Mr. Coleman being a perpetrator? Was it relevant?
Identity in what? The robbery?
Well, I mean, the fact that he was, and I'll see what Mr. McCarthy's argument is, that the robbery takes place within minutes. We have the assault with the deadly weapon issue, 10 minutes, whatever it is, in the time period here, and that was Mr. Coleman was involved in that incident, and his identity issue. Does that tie into NRS 48.045 and make it cross-admissible in the robbery case? Could that
First, I have to tell you that nowhere at trial did the district attorney ever use the evidence of the ADW to prove robbery. I harvested out of the record what the DA used. And in each incident, the DA used the Murillo to prove Weaver. The state never at any time in the court below used Weaver to prove Murillo. So you ask about identity on the robbery, that's a non-issue. It wasn't even there.
Okay.
And it wasn't used. It wasn't real. And it wasn't argued. It wasn't argued in the brief. I mean, there was some attempt to do that, but the only use, there was three uses, and it was all propensity. You know, we know that he'd used the gun with Officer Weaver because he used the gun with Murillo. Objection overruled. That's straight, rank propensity. Well, he used a gun. No, that doesn't come in under, and then just to get here in the next 90 seconds, if I could, you know, the 173.115, okay, just the raw argument on the severance, it doesn't come in under anything. It's not the same act or transaction. What they're trying to do under Fouquet or whatever, although they didn't even argue that, really, I raised it, is that, you know, robbery is this expansive crime. It's not. It's not the same act or transaction. Didn't involve the same victim. So what's up to connected together or constituting a common scheme or plan. We know from Fields, Justice Cherry's decision of about a year and a half ago, and from the Weber decision, that the same actor or common scheme or plan has to be an overarching, preconceived, intended circumstance, which is not here. And then the other one, connected together, goes right into cross-admissibility. Cross-admissibility doesn't work here for all of the reasons we talked about. I mean, it's not really relevant. There wasn't a limiting instruction out of Tabish. They referenced a Bean v. Calderon. There was absolutely no cautionary limiting instruction, either under Tavares, even at the time it came in, or at the time...
Did you request the limiting instruction?
Yes, repeatedly, and repeatedly refused. And I referenced the specific points in the record when I do that. Repeatedly requested, repeatedly refused. The court made no finding of more substantially or more probative than prejudicial, made no prejudice finding. It didn't do what it had to do to get other bad acts in. And under connected together, it is a straight OBA 48045 with all the Petrocelli and a Tinch and the whole procedure required to let in other bad acts. And that wasn't done here. It resulted in a train wreck. I ask you to reverse for a fair trial on each of the two charges.
Thank you, Mr. Witness. You'll have about a little over 4 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McCarthy, on behalf of the state of Nevada.
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm still Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. You know, severance issues can cover a wide range. There are some, like in Tavish, where it's an abuse of discretion to not allow it. And the vast majority of cases could go either way. This is at the other extreme. This would have been an abuse to require two trials that are going to be virtually identical. By the way, I did some calculations last night. This morning, the two crime scenes are approximately 100 yards apart. At a normal pace, my pace for an old fat guy, I can walk that in about 83 seconds. So,
is that in the record or the rough?
No, that's my calculations. 100 yards is in the record. How long it takes an old fat guy to walk 100 yards is my statement. So, but that's, you can figure out how many yards in a mile and all that. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So it appears to be the two crime scenes were very close in time, very close geographically. They are intimately related. The assault on Officer Weaver does indeed show this person is present near the scene of the crime, at the scene of the crime. Remember, the victim of the robbery heard the gunshot as he's seeking out, he heard at least one gunshot as he's seeking out help, which is another reason to show they're pretty darn close together.
Why would the robbery be relevant if he had been tried separately on ADW? What would your argument be for introducing evidence of the robbery?
Well, one, I see no chance at all that this would have gone to trial on the separate assault without somebody claiming that cop planted that gun. So if he had the gun earlier on the way to the scene of the assault, that would certainly be relevant. But... it also provides his explanation, his motive for avoiding contact with the cops. Why? Because he's got his pockets full of stolen goods, you know, the stolen money in the ATM card. But this is, even if only the ADW would be admissible for the robbery, but not the other way around, let's think about what that would mean. That would mean two trials, one for crimes A and B, and then another one for only crime B. That doesn't make any sense.
But the law is that they have to be mutually cross-admissible. I mean, you're arguing with the precedent that says mutual cross-admissibility is the test on severance.
The mutual cross-admissibility is a factor that enters into it. I think they are. I think both of these trials would be virtually the same.
I understand that that's your position, but Right. The argument you just made is that that law makes no sense.
It would make no sense to have two trials, one with all the evidence and then the second one with only part of the evidence. That would make no sense at all. And by the way, You don't need a Tavares instruction when there's no uncharged misconduct. When it's charged, you don't need an instruction about uncharged misconduct. So they are cross-admissible. They are close in time and place. And it's never a question of mutually exclusive evidence or entirely complementary evidence. It's always a question of the degree of overlap. And that's why the court ought to give special, extraordinary deference to the trial court in this case, because before trial, before the evidence is even presented, the trial court is called upon to anticipate the degree of overlap. There's never been two trials where there's no overlap at all. So when you have the degree of overlap, and if they are clearly severable, I mean, separate, you know, so the jury can see them separately, might as well do them together. There's no risk of prejudice involved. But I guess I would also point out, I was reading recently some U.S. Supreme Court cases on severance, and they have a presumption in favor of trying things together when there's some relationship. And the reason is to avoid, one of the reasons, is to avoid possibility of freakish results. I think that's a good reason for it. I think that's a good reason for trying them together. We don't want freakish results. So here, I think all the evidence is cross-admissible, and there's just no reason to try them separately.
So you're saying even if the court had charged him with robbery, and then when you did a Petrocelli motion for the assault with the deadly weapon, it would have been admissible under 48045 in the robbery case.
To show that he had, not only is a gun in his pocket or in his hand immediately when it's shot, but he had it a couple minutes before. It wasn't planted. It wasn't left there by someone else. The goods, the money in the ATM card, it all comes in both of them, I think. So I don't see any problem with that at all.
Does Petrocelli say that you'd have to do a Petrocelli hearing if it's charged in another information or indictment?
No. 48045 talks about other crimes, wrongs, or acts. If it's charged offense, it's not an other crime, wrong, or act. So
I'm talking about a different information or indictment. Let's say there was a severance.
Yes.
And there was a robbery case and an assault case. Could the robbery be introduced in the assault case and the assault in the robbery case without Tavares and without Petrocelli?
Oh, no. If they were being tried separately, there'd have to be an instruction on it, and the court would have to determine that they were cross-admissible.
But if they're in the same charging document, information or indictment, you wouldn't have to do, at least you're claiming you don't have to do a Petrocelli or have a Tavares instruction or Finch or anything like that.
I don't see how you could have a Petrocelli instruction or Petrocelli hearing to determine if uncharged misconduct can be admitted when it's charged misconduct. So,
and you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury then. Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Rather than clear and convincing.
Right.
Pardon me?
It's a different burden of proof.
Oh, yeah. So, and I would, random thoughts here, by the way. Prior to trial, this was initially a defense motion for joinder. The defense sought joinder. The only thing that changed after that is the identity of the lawyer.
Well, I see. Yeah, I kind of looked at the history of the case where Mr. Wittes came in, and there was the public defender, I think, before that, and there were some conflicts between Mr. Coleman and his attorney, and Mr. Wittes came in subsequent to that.
Right. So nothing changed after the defense sought joinder, and there's been no specific claim of prejudice. In my opinion, this is well tried and well argued, with very little overlap. In the argument, they were kept fairly separate, except that identity became a non-issue after the evidence of the incident with Officer Weaver. It became no longer a big deal. It was proved that had this been tried separately, it would have been admissible to show, yes, this is the guy in the puffy jacket in the middle of summer, and he's got the stolen goods with him. And he's got the gun with him, and he's got the taser device, whatever that's called. So, in my opinion, it's all cross-admissible. There is another, there is a suggestion in the briefs that in order to be cross-admissible evidence has to be absolutely necessary. That's not a correct standard. The state is not limited to one form of proof, especially here, where the question of identity of the robber is called into question. You can have all sorts of corroborative evidence. So much of the evidence of each would be used to corroborate the other, in particular, his presence at the scene of the crime.
Mr. McCarthy, what do you think about the argument on the materiality of the bank records of Ms. Davis and the $1,500 and all that? How does that play into the case?
Well, if I may quote my friend Dennis Wittes, it was proposed impeachment on a collateral matter. When it came up, that was his comment. Let's see, what else?
So you're saying it wouldn't be allowed under NRS to impeach her with the records and all as a collateral matter?
If you had done the investigation before trial, it might have been allowable. I think it is impeachment with extrinsic evidence on a collateral matter. And when someone stands up and calls it a collateral matter and then says, can I have a certificate of materiality, when having just described it as not material, I suggest there's no abuse in not giving that. I would point out that I still don't know what bank. I don't know who it was supposed to be addressed to.
So it was a bank. It was allegedly in a bank account, the way I understood the record. So they wanted a certificate, I guess, just to examine that bank to see if the money was there.
I still don't know what bank.
Okay.
So make it difficult.
Can I ask you another question? And again, Mr. Wittes, I know, focused on the severance issue,
sure,
which appears to be the primary issue, but this issue in the grand jury proceedings, we've seen that come up before. Our Justice Cherry and I had another case in Clark County with somewhat, you know, the indictment coming in and all like that. Tell us about your position on that.
Geez, you're not going to consolidate me with another Clark County case, are you?
Well, no. I think it was affirmed, but I just want to say what you think.
Although we're looking for some cases for Wendover.
Oh, Wendover. Okay.
But we probably won't send you there. You know?
Yeah. Cheryl Bond and I were talking about that. When we were younger, that would have been a grand adventure. The authority of a grand jury to issue a superseding indictment has been recognized in this court since statehood. Nothing's changed here. They added a new charge of attempted murder, and then the explanation of what happened is in the record. Subsequent investigation revealed that the hammer had not fallen on the round in the chamber, and so the prosecutor dismissed the new charge. And that, contrary to the answering reply brief, that is all in the record, the explanation for it. But so a grand jury has fairly broad authority to inquire into anything affecting the health, welfare, morals, you know. So the fact that one has already been charged with some crimes doesn't preclude the grand jury from looking into other crimes.
No need for leave of court in that situation?
No, we need leave of court to file an amended information, but I don't think you need leave of court to go get an indictment. And by the way, there was a waiver of time. There's repeated arguments about the assertion of the right to a speedy trial that was waived quite explicitly. And
what about the procedures of the Reno Police Department and whether or not the officer violated their procedures? Would that have some relevance that the judge didn't let Mr. Wittes go into?
I'm not sure of the relevance, because the claim is that other officers violated, you know, standard operating procedure. That is, a detective talked to Officer Weaver, a detective from the Reno Police Department. How that would impeach a testimony of Weaver, I don't know. But more importantly, there was nothing excluded. At no time did this district court rule, no, you can't do this. Before trial, the court said, I'll reserve ruling on it. There's an objection at one point during opening statements, and the objection is because the court had reserved ruling. That's all. Later, during the trial, Weaver's testifying, defense was allowed to get into everything that they asked to get into. And the judge asked, what's your relevance? And there was a lack of an explanation. But I've been through this record with a fine-tooth comb. I can't find where the court said, no, you may not introduce evidence of the protocol. All you have to do is make it relevant somehow. There was the failure. but it was never offered and excluded. Had it been offered, whether it would have been excluded would depend on when it was offered and the purpose for which it was offered and the circumstances.
Could you comment on your colleague's argument with respect to the jury instruction differing from the charge with respect to pointing the weapon versus on the ADW?
Sure. There was pointing is not an element.
Understood, so. But he was charged with pointing the weapon.
Right.
His point is that the jury instructions deviated from the charge.
I have a couple comments. One, if there's a deviation at all, it's a minor deviation. Pointing is not a term of art. The testimony at trial, sometimes it said pointing, sometimes it said waving. Now, I suppose we could have the NFL write our penal code and said there must be a complete halt in order for there to be an assault, but there isn't one. I would also point out there's no proffered instruction, no objection to the instructions, and therefore it would have to be viewed on plain error. I suggest that it is not plain error to instruct on the elements of the offense, the statutory elements. If someone wants to draw attention to one of those elements, we call that a theory of defense instruction, and, well, we know what happened to them, but no one did. So I don't think it's plain error to instruct on the elements of the offense. I also don't think that there's a grave difference between pointing and waving. The officer said that the man stopped, he turned, pulled his pistol, and he's waving his arm. You know, he's trying to draw a bead, but he's not alleged to have drawn a sight picture and squeezed the trigger. Pointing and waving are not grossly different. If that's a variance at all, it is a minor variance. I don't think it's a variance at all myself. Give me that one second. I'm done here.
The court has no questions. Mr. Wittes, your rebuttal? 4 minutes and 8 seconds.
Allow me to bullet point, because that's all that we can do at this point. Moving backwards in time, woefully inaccurate. Officer Weaver repeatedly, prior to trial, testified clearly and consistently and demonstratively about how Mr. Coleman allegedly stopped, turned, extended his arm, and pointed a gun. And only after that did he then discharge 7 shots at him, hitting him twice, after which Mr. Coleman then dropped the gun and fell to the ground. After the forensic pathologist presented her report showing that Mr. Coleman was probably on the ground when Officer Weaver shot, as confirmed by the testimony of Nieder and Robinson, that they saw the whole thing. He never raised his arms. And in fact, Robinson testified to watching Weaver point his gun down and shooting the shots. Okay, the whole theory on this thing is not some minor variance, is that this was a cover-up and a whitewash of a bad police shooting. All the protocol, the failure of Officer Weaver to follow contact and cover, the failure of Officer Weaver, this is a meet and greet. It's not even a Terry stop. He had no probable cause, maybe arguably reasonable suspicion. That's one of the suppression issues that we can't even talk about here that are kind of huge. But you know, Officer Weaver did not get cover, did not wait until a safe opportunity, violated repeatedly, one after another, of these basic training principles of officer safety, found himself out in what was essentially a dark killing zone or whatever, 20 feet away from Mr. Coleman as he's just about ready to get into the dark. Coleman, our theory is he slipped and fell. This happens. Officer Weaver is there. He discharges his weapon 7 times from 20 feet away at this guy. Shoots him while he's on the ground. Okay, of course, that would be hugely devastating to Officer Weaver's career as a police officer. Okay, clearly there's a motive by breaching all of these rules for him to fabricate. But no, we couldn't get into that. Again, in the briefs, I've referenced in the record where I preserve this stuff, where I made my record both pre-trial and at trial, and the woefully inadequate representation Mr. Coleman got from his defender originally with this motion for joinder. She didn't know what to do. When the district attorney went in 12 days before trial, got an attempted murder charge on the same basic facts, there was no forensic evidence. Please, the record is clear. There was no new forensic evidence adduced after the grand jury proceedings. Everything that Mr. Pearson had going into the grand jury, he had after the grand jury, and that was Mr. Ladiak, who said that the hammer coulda, maybe, did not, you know, fall on the weapon. Okay, back to severance, if I could. Okay, the Beam v. Calderon referenced in Tabish, there has to be a cautionary limiting instruction. There has to be. This, you know, clearly in an other bad acts case, to say that a careful limiting instruction is not necessary, that's totally contrary to what the court has said in Tabish, and then I think referenced in Weber as well. And in Beam v. Calderon, they found reversible error from a state conviction for the failure to, quote, specifically admonish jurors that they could not consider evidence of one set of offenses as evidence establishing the other, close quote. That's out of 163 Fed 3rd at 1083. And so what we've got here is an absolute failure of the lower court to assure that there wasn't this spillover prejudice from the one charge to the other. Mr. Coleman failed to get a fair trial on either of these charges, and the only way he could have done so was in separate trials where there was an opportunity for defense counsel to prove up its case and to challenge the state's proof properly pursuant to the rules of evidence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Woodis. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Both of you, excellent arguments, excellent briefs. This matter will stand submitted.